Today is Veterans Day, November 11th, 2009, and because of that, we have a very, very special program designed for you today. We have some special guests in the studio, along with Raul Reese. We would like to introduce them to you. Pete Ciccatelli, Tom Camateris, and Pete Silva is with us, along with Raul. What we would like to do is introduce everybody to you at this time, or at least have each person introduce themselves. So we'll start out with Ciccatelli.
I'm Pete Ciccatelli from Port Chester, New York. I was enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1966. Was discharged as a corporal. I served with these guys in Vietnam with Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment.
And what was going on in your life at the time that you signed up?
At the time, I was in college, but running out of funds, so I decided, since I was summoned for my physical, to be drafted by the Army, that I would enlist in the Marine Corps, so I did so.
And Pete Silva?
When I retired, I was a corporal, and in my life at that time, when I was drafted, I was working, and I had marriage plans going.
And Tom Camateris?
Yeah, I'm from Phoenix, Arizona. At the time that I joined the Marine Corps in 1966 was when the draft was going on. I wasn't aware of what my draft number was. I just hadn't done that well in my first year in school or 2 years in school, and decided that I owed my country service and was proud to serve with these Marines here.
So, Raul, you served with all of these guys.
Yes.
43 years ago in Alpha 17. Let me ask the question. Why would somebody at that time join up when a lot of guys were running to Canada to try to avoid the draft?
Well, I guess a lot of people had a patriotic duty, and I remember it was the thing to do. If you weren't going to school, our country was in a little bit of trouble and needed some help, and a lot of people joined, and I guess the rest is history. Right?
When you said the country was in a little bit of trouble, what did you know about Vietnam?
Well, we knew that it was a communist country, and that the South Vietnamese were being oppressed by the North, and I guess it kind of went against our rules for freedom. You know, these people in the South didn't want to be governed by communists in the North, so it was our understanding that we were going there to stop the spread of communism.
Pete Silva, so from the time you sign up, how long does it take before you're doing push-ups at boot camp? what happens? What's that process?
I think it was about a month and a half after from the processing center. You know, they sent us back home, and then they sent us out another letter to meet at a certain place, and everybody catches the bus there, and San Diego, here we come.
And when you get there, you go, what? What did I do? Or
what the heck am I doing here?
It's quite a shock.
Yeah.
So you guys all served together in Vietnam. So what was the first feeling that you had when your boots hit the ground there in Vietnam? What did you see and what did you feel?
You know, I think one of the things that I want to share with these guys, because I was born in Mexico City, so when I came here, I felt immediately as an American. And even when I was 10 years old, I was always thinking I was going to join the military. And then the war, of course, broke. I was a senior in high school. I graduated from high school. And that's when I decided, I was in trouble already, so I decided to go ahead and join the Marine Corps. And then when I got over to Vietnam, I met these guys here, which were the most amazing people that I ever in my life. These guys were just amazing. And it was a real hard time for all of us, because we really did not understand, you know, why we couldn't sometimes load and be fired upon. And then we had to load our rifles and then fire the enemy. And at the same time, there was a lot of things going through our minds, you know, because we saw a lot of our friends get wounded and get hurt.
So what did it feel like knowing that you were there possibly to kill another human being? And how did you deal with that mentally back then? And did you actually have to do it?
Yeah, I don't think there's any lessons that you're taught in how to deal with the stress of war. I think 18 to 21-year-olds mostly categorize the information and then process it as fast as they can to not have to deal with the pain every day, because the next day it's going to happen again to someone else, and you just became callous to it. either that or you lived in fear for the whole time. And I don't ever remember anybody's eyes saying, hey, I'm afraid after I've been there a month. You just become callous to the events around you.
Did you feel that the Vietnamese people wanted you there?
At times they did. And at times people didn't care. They'd go about their business and they just wouldn't care.
The Vietnamese had been in war for 30 years before that
the
French.
That's right.
I mean, all the trenches and stuff that they used there had been dug by the French. Mm-hmm. And so the Vietnamese had been, that was their normal day, seeing people and soldiers fighting. I don't ever remember anybody except the children after you gave them some cigarettes or candy saying thank you.
That's right.
And honestly, don't remember anybody putting their arms around somebody saying thanks for being in our country, because I don't think they ever quite understood it.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's kind of the same sentiment that's going on in Iraq today?
It's kind of hard to tell because, you reflect back on our experience, and I'm not sure anybody knew if the people of Vietnam were happy to see us, and you hear so many conflicting stories coming from Iraq and Afghanistan today. But I think if you ask the soldiers, I believe they think that the people there, the oppressed people there, are happy to see them. Maybe the people they're fighting against aren't too happy, but it seems, I get the impression that those oppressed people in those places are happy that Americans are there to help liberate them.
You guys were in Vietnam in what year, 67?
66 and 67.
Yeah.
In 68, did you miss the Tet Offensive, or were you mm-hmm. there for that?
No, we missed it.
You missed it.
We missed that one, yep. But there was a Tet Offensive every year.
Every year.
Tet is New Year. That's what that means.
Okay.
Yep. And there was always a truce at Tet, and so we weren't allowed to fire without permission.
Yep.
And yet they would offer their offensive at the same time because they knew they could walk into areas that they normally wouldn't be not shot at.
It's like our hands were tied, you know? I mean, it was a real situation where we were there. We didn't really understand. We were young. We were 18, 19 years old, you know? And we had gone with, as Americans, and we were patriots, for America. And then when we got there, they start telling us you can't lock and load unless you're fired upon. When you're in the field, you don't feel like the guys are in the office. You know what I'm saying? You're out there and you're getting shot at and you're thinking, they're going to kill me. So what do? You know, so that's the things that we had to face in Vietnam.
So, and it was a thing where the politicians were running the war,
yes.
In a sense.
But we followed the rules of the Geneva Convention. Mm-hmm. And one of those rules was when there was a truce, like there was for the Tet, that you wouldn't fire unless fired upon. However, the enemy took advantage of that. And it was a sticky situation, but it was all one-sided.
Talk a little bit about napalm and how it was used over in Vietnam.
Well, to think that we had air superiority and couldn't win that war has always frustrated me. But the close air support we'd get from the Phantom jets from the Marine Corps and the Navy, and when they dropped the napalm bombs, it was a mess. I mean, that was the one you didn't want to get close to because that stuff stuck to everything. But the fireballs those things could throw up and the smell of that gas after it was burning was something that you just never forget.
Yeah.
So how long were you guys there, and did you ever feel like you weren't coming home?
I was there for 13 months. Probably the first day that I was there, I knew I wasn't going to come home. I never thought that I was going to come home.
You got a Purple Heart too?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Silva, how long were you there?
I was there 7 months before I got wounded. And,
tell them a little bit of what happened to you.
I stepped on a booby trap, and that ended my career as a Marine over there, and I got shipped back home. But
you were awarded the Bronze Star,
yes.
Which is the
yes.
fourth highest award for bravery, heroism, and meritorious service.
Right? He was a good Marine, boy, I tell you that.
So when you come under fire by the enemy and you're in that tight spot that you were talking about earlier, how do you call in a strike, and what kind of help was
actually
can
tell
available
you that
to
he was
you?
Our leader.
Oftentimes you wouldn't be allowed to call in an airstrike. I mean, an airstrike, there has to be something serious happening, and it must be happening to more than just a few guys. But so the close air support, calling in the choppers and for medevacs, that was probably what we did more than anything else, and calling in artillery strikes. And that was something that either you learned on the job or as you're going through the rank of promotions, you go to NCO school and be trained on calling in medevacs and airstrikes and artillery. But we'd call in artillery more often than we'd call in airstrikes.
Yep. Well, back in 1967, of course, we didn't have CNN. And so here, stateside, we really didn't truly know what was going on over in Vietnam, other than the little bits of information that they would, you know, feed us.
Yeah, now, you were here. What did you see, Bobby, in that time?
Well, a lot of it was propaganda about... Well, first of all, let me say this. Mm-hmm. They never called it a war for, you know, a very long time. It was a Vietnam conflict. They stayed away from the word war until the last couple of years of the war, because we've had troops in there. Eisenhower, I think, sent advisors in there. Mm-hmm. He was the first to send it, and it went on for a long time. As more and more boys came back in body bags,
right,
and without arms and legs, and as more and more mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters saw their sons coming home and friends coming home, people began to become more and more against the war.
Boisterous.
In Vietnam,
yeah.
and there were demonstrations. A lot of them were supposed to be peaceful, but a lot of them turned out to be quite the opposite. So my reason for even asking that question is because I was interested in understanding what information you guys were getting on your end and what you thought what was going on here in the United States.
We had very little communication.
Yeah.
There was no electronics. Well, in our stay in July, and all four of us spent part of our tour in July, until we moved to Da Nang, where there was a big PX and somebody bought a battery operated phonograph. We didn't hear music and we didn't have a radio, and we didn't listen to Good Morning Vietnam. I don't ever remember hearing that phrase spoken of.
Yep.
that guy that was talking to the troops all the time.
Yeah. Well, we were in touch with the outside world.
Oh, we hadn't.
We were in the field the whole time. Yeah, all the time, in and out.
The only communication we had was our letters to family members, and there was never anything said to us about, or not to me anyway, about what the general opinion was back home. So we were just there doing our job. There was a newspaper in country called Stars and Stripes, but I don't think I ever saw it. Well, while we were there, so we really didn't know until we got home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and also, I mean, not only did the people, the young people, especially college students and the young people here in the United States, not only did they think it was a war that we shouldn't be fighting, there was also reports of a lot of heavy drug use and heroin and, you know,
from the
was that going
you know what?
On?
That's one thing that we never saw in our in our squads. We never saw that.
It started
at
the end of our tour. When I left California to go to Vietnam, we're listening to the Association play Along Comes Mary, mm-hmm. and the Four Tops and the Temptations, and we come back to the Electric Prunes and the Jefferson Airplane, and all society changed in 1967. If nobody's remember, he serves them. Miniskirts came out.
That's right.
The music industry went from calm. The drug culture began.
Mm-hmm.
Men started wearing their hair long, which they hadn't when we left.
Yep.
And most of my friends were part of those people. And so I had some letter contact with folks that would say, hey, everybody's doing this back in the States, and everybody's doing this, and I'm going, I don't even know what it is. But by the time we left, we'd all had the opportunity to be introduced to it, mm-hmm. because somebody go into Da Nang or a city and somebody come back with a, what they called a stick of marijuana or something, and you're going, what is this?
Yeah,
well, the you know, the general attitude, the general impression that people had here was that there was like, everybody was getting high.
Well, this is why we were shocked. I mean, when we came home, I mean, we felt like we went over there to do our job, and when we came home, you know, everybody, they were spitting at people and calling us baby killers and all that stuff. When we went in and we volunteered, we signed up to defend our country as our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents had done in the past.
Yes, sir.
You know, and then here we are, you know, we're baby killers, and yet, you know, they're holding our hands and tying our hands up. And while these guys are going over there and we, you know, they're coming back in body bags, they're getting killed. You know, and nobody really knows until you're in combat, you know, the real situation and the pressure that people are under, you know, when that really happens. So a lot of times, like Kamatera said, people are naive. They don't really know what's going on until you're in country, and then you know.
Yeah, and actually what was going on also, as to extend on what we've already mentioned, is that the kids were growing their hair long, and there was a separation between the kids were the hippies, mm-hmm. the druggies, yeah. and the hippies, and the police were the pigs. So there was this wide separation between establishment mm-hmm. and the young people. And the young people were definitely anti-establishment. The press was not so much anti-establishment at first, and the older people. And I think one of the main reasons why the young people were anti-establishment was because there was a draft, mm-hmm. and they didn't want to be drafted.
Right.
So, you know, that was one of the major reasons why they were opposing the war. But before the whole thing was over, I mean, they hated the president. They hated anything to do with the government. They hated, you know. And then, of course, Nixon got us out, actually, in 75. And now you guys are coming home, and I don't know if you're expecting parades or whatever. But
when you came home, what you could tell, what happened to you?
I thought I was coming home as a hero. And when I did get home and got the feel for the popular opinion towards our troops there, it was kind of, hey, maybe I'm not the hero that I think I am.
Did you feel proud?
I was proud because of who I was there and who I left behind there and who I was with there. And as you can tell, 42 years later, I'm with the same guys there. So they're my brothers. They'll always be my brothers.
So was it hard to assimilate back into American society?
You know, one thing that we didn't mention was that I think Vietnam was probably the first war that we fought where the enemy was not clearly identifiable. I mean, Korea, World War II, the wars before us. I mean, conventional warfare had one country on one side fighting, you know, another uniform on the other side. Here we were fighting guerrillas. We were fighting not only the North Vietnamese Army, but the Viet Cong, who were guerrillas and, not identifiable. Women and children were guerrillas. It wasn't just young men in black pajamas with carbines
That's
slung
what
over
made
their
it
back.
Hard. Yeah.
So, and another thing I think is the average age was 19 years old, and a stimulus like marijuana or something like that might be a beneficial to somebody who's under such tremendous stress was something that was easily available and taken advantage of maybe, but
the part that came from the drugs to the troops started with the guys that had already introduced themselves to the experience before they came over. Mm-hmm. So every year you had somebody else coming over. And so at the end of our tours, these guys have already experienced the drug culture and they're bringing it over with them.
Yeah, they're bringing the Jimi Hendrix.
That's a good point.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's right. When I got home, I'm listening to Jimi Hendrix and then find out he was a proud service member of the 101st Airborne.
That's right.
Yeah. And also, not only were you fighting against people that were not in uniforms, I think apart from the Korean War, all other wars, World War II, World War I, these were wars that we knew that if we lost, those they would be on our soil.
That's right.
And they would enslave us or kill us all.
Yes.
You know? So this was the kind of war that wasn't really a direct threat to the actual soil of the United States of America.
And let me mention for a second, though, there was actually two distinct wars going on in Vietnam. We had never had a guerrilla warfare before.
Right.
And that's what we experienced in our entire tours, was tripping booby traps and being sniped at by people in pajamas.
That's right.
When we moved from Chu Lai to Da Nang and got on their airplane, we didn't know positively where that airplane was landing, and we thought we might be going to Khe Sanh or the DMZ.
Yes.
And there they saw myriads of guys in uniforms trying to take their hill from them every night, mm-hmm. and would get close enough to drop mortars in on them every night and would rush the wire every night. And that's more conventional than what you expect to happen. We were always beaten up by the unexpected. We didn't ever know when it was going to happen because you didn't know where the next tripwire was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pete Silva, tell them a little bit about how what you feel about it when you came back. How did they treat you?
My friends didn't come over.
Yeah.
A few did come by, and now that I see them years after, every time I see them, I give them a hug.
Yeah.
You know, I remember who came by.
Yeah.
Say hello.
And let me mention.
And other people didn't care.
Pete is a double amputee.
Yes, he is.
He hadn't mentioned that yet.
Yeah. Tell them what happened, Kamateris, with us.
We were out on patrol going into one of the villages, and we had a new man walking point, and he was taken forever. Mm-hmm. And our fire team was on the end of the column. We were rearing Charlie. And Silva turns to me and says, "Cam, I'm taking point because we're going to be out here all night." And 5 minutes later, he stepped into that punji pit with a booby trap in it.
He lost both of his legs.
And Raul, were.
I was there, and that's when Kamateris in his log, that's a little log that he wrote down, and that's when I really lost my mind, I think, of Kamateris. I was pretty upset about it because Pete, when I looked at Pete, he was on his face. Both of his legs were gone, and it was just horrible, you know. I mean, it was so it brought a lot of anxiety, a lot of hate in my heart, and the village was right there. And we were ready. We were ready to do whatever we had to do. And here's our friend, our brother, you know, that we love. I mean, any one of us here, you know. We really feel like, you know, we're family. Mm-hmm. I don't think a lot of people understand that.
Well, nobody can share that experience.
No, no.
Except you guys.
That's why I love Kamateris so much, and Silva and all these guys, because they're my real brothers. They've never betrayed me. They will never betray me. You know, we've been through a lot, and we know that we love each other. And there's a lot of people that do not love like that.
Kamateris kept a diary.
Yes, he did.
And
yes, he did.
That was helpful in the upcoming film.
For us, understood a lot of things,
you have an upcoming film that we're releasing, which is Quiet Hope 2.
It's called,
Taking the Hill.
Taking the Hill.
And I imagine that played an important part in helping to put that together.
Yeah. Right?
Well, I don't know. I hadn't read it for 20 years afterwards. And I even at one point when I went to journalism school tried to sit down and write something about Vietnam and never even once thought about the diary until I'd made contact mm-hmm. with Pete Ciccatelli. And then I found my diary again, moving from house to house, and read part of it because I thought I'd had a very easy tour of duty over there compared to those guys up at the DMZ.
Yeah.
Then I read the book and went, my God, this was a lot worse than I remember.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's how I dealt with the negatives. I categorized it and stuck it in a file and put it back in the dark place and left it there for years.
And tell them what your goal was to look for all these guys.
Well, in the midst of us making this film and everything, we've been to the wall. And after we went to the wall and I got home with my diary, and in the back of the diary, I have three names written in that book. And 40 years later, I walked to the wall with the only three guys that gave me their name and address back in the world. And that was one of the most amazing experiences in my life.
So when you got back into reading your diary...
I still haven't read the whole thing.
You haven't read the whole thing. So did it leave a pit in your stomach in reading it, and you didn't want to finish it?
Because, no, I wasn't really that detailed. I was 20 years old and hadn't started journalism school yet. I was in business school in my first 2 years in college. And so I wasn't as detailed, but I do have a few names, and I had most of the big experiences, but I never went into detail. I always called people by their nicknames, so I can read a name in the book and go, I have no idea who this guy was, because I only have Rod as his name, and I don't know what his first name was, because we called him by their last name or what their nickname was.
He's an incredible writer, seriously. I mean, even in the shorthand that he did, when I read it, he blew me away, because you know what? I started reading it every single day that he wrote down, and not only did it bring back memories, but you know what? I thought this guy, he's my brother that wrote down things that we never understood until we read it. You know, he gave a copy to each one of us, and it was just an amazing thing that he really had those names in back of his, you know, in back of his book, and at the same time, the love and the care that he had for each one of us, you know, to find ourselves, and then to go to the wall together, to be able to find these guys after all these years, and then do this documentary that is going to go all over the world, and is going to affect all the Afghanistan, Iraqi kids, and Korea, and World War I, and World War II. It doesn't matter who it is.
So did any of you go back into combat, or do you go back into combat mode from time to time now that you're back here, even after all these years?
I think that all of us, you know, have memories. I mean, Camp can share, Silva can share. Chick, you ever had any problems?
Well, I, you know, we're old men now,
yep.
And the memories, you know, those memories that were lasting for us for such a long time seem to be diminishing now, for me anyway. But I remember there was the smell of blood and gunpowder together was a smell that I smelled for at least 10 years after I came home. It just never went away. It was sort of like smelling, you know, any smell, a gasoline smell, for instance. You know, if you're in a gas station, you smell it all day long, and you just, it's just part of you. Well, that blood and gunpowder smell stayed with me for at least 10 years. And, you know, from time to time, my wife would be upset when I would watch the movies about Vietnam because they would always bother me. And, you know, we all had our stresses and problems with that. It's, you know, you can't go to war and not pay a price. Everybody pays a price. Yeah. And the price you pay is your own, and they're different for everybody. But, you know, we did manage to become old men.
How about you, Silva?
The biggest memories I have of that is just the wounded that I saw
yeah.
in the little bit of time that I was there. But it didn't carry over into nightmares or loss right. of sleep.
Right.
I thank God, you know,
yeah.
that didn't happen to me.
How about you, Kim?
No, my major problems didn't come with thinking about it. It came in the subconscious with me sleepwalking and sleep disturbance. I mean, until recently when I finally had positive treatment from the VA, I hadn't slept in 40 years.
Yeah.
And I would get up after an hour every night. And then people that I lived with would tell me that I was walking a sentry in the middle of the night, but I looked like a zombie.
Yeah.
But so, and I still sleepwalk from time to time.
I can concur yeah. with that because I don't sleep either. I haven't slept a full night since I was in high school. And it's just, it's almost like... It never ended from the time we returned home till now, 40 years, haven't had a night's sleep since.
And imagine, like with me.
Had flashbacks, right?
Well, 2 years ago when I got I was doing the Kendall swords, getting hit in the head for 4 years, and I never had a flashback like that. And then all of a sudden, I'm here coming home, and I get sick, and I have a little thing from my navel to my brain, and then I'm running down the street thinking the VCR trying to kill me, calling Sharon. She comes to my house. She finds me on the floor. And then for 6 weeks, I'm totally gone, sick. I can't speak. And even here at the church when I was ministering on Wednesday and Sunday, I had a minute and 20 second. Remember those
yeah,
events that I would have? I couldn't speak. I couldn't think. And then all of a sudden, I'm right back here again. But you know what? God was really good enough to me to help me, you know, and to get the treatment that I needed to get, because otherwise there's no possible way.
So you're doing okay now?
I'm doing fine now, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of guys that when they come back, they don't want to talk about Vietnam at all, and a lot of them will stay to themselves. And you guys seem pretty open and, you know, ready to talk about it. So obviously you've learned to deal with your experiences.
I would like
over
to say
years.
Something, Bobby, because
yes.
these guys, because I think that Kim can really confirm this. I think that there are the guys like all of us here that really have been in battle, have really seen. There's a lot of guys out there that really make up a lot of stories, and there's a lot of things that are not true. And I think you have to be a realist and really come to the truth in your own life, because I know people like that. But at the same time, you can tell the guys that went there, they don't like to talk about it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's behind us. We don't, the only reason we're talking about it is because we're doing a documentary, and we want people to be helped. You know, and we want to know that we're human, and we're, you know, we've gone through a lot of stuff in our lives, and we have to deal with our lives. But there's a lot of people out there that might be even cheating, you know, the government, you know, getting pensions stuff like that when they've really never had any problems, and maybe even ever been in combat.
You hear somebody talking about it all the time.
Yeah.
perhaps they weren't there.
Yes, that's right. That's right. But I know the Cam, I mean, he was, I mean, and Chicatelli and Silva, you know, to me, these guys, I mean, they blew me away and they continue to blow me. I thank God that I was able to come back and see these guys and that they're part of my life and part of my family until the day that we die because of what God has done.
Now, are you guys involved with veterans groups now and helping?
I'm not. I never really got involved with any veterans groups. Maybe that goes back to, disengaging from the Vietnam. You know, Cam wrote me a letter after we had both come home, and I never answered him. And I guess I regret it to this day, but there's proof that someone that was so close to me that I loved, that was my brother, and I wanted to forget him. I think that goes a long way in saying how we tried to disengage ourselves. But now, you know, we're together, we're brothers, we share things that only the four of us can share.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we didn't talk about it to others, and I did, I kind of think, I like to believe that I was very open, and I talked to anybody who wanted me to talk to them because it was good for me. It was good to clear my mind and get it off my chest, and it never bothered me to talk about it. But when I'm here with these guys, with my brothers, it's different.
This is the healing process right here.
This is different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you that I never was allowed to talk about it. My friends were all in school, and my friends were all anti-war demonstrators, of which at the end of the war, I was demonstrating against the war because I don't want any more boys hurt in a war that wasn't going to accomplish what we thought it might. The same point in time, I want to tell those guys coming home today that they've defined what PTSD is now. They've defined the symptoms. You need to be aware of those symptoms, and you need to be unafraid to get treatment. Because I don't think between the four of us, any of us even, well, until the phrase PTSD had even been invented yet, I didn't have anybody that I've ever told. None of my closest friends know anything that ever happened to me.
That's right.
They don't know one thing, one patrol. I never could tell them a story because they just say, man, it's so bad that we don't want to hear about war.
Well, in wrapping up, and you just gave some advice, but what advice and insight the rest of you give to our troops now fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan and other parts of the world?
If I would say to them, go back to your VAs and seek a counselor, tell them your symptoms, what you're thinking, give them your thought of mind, and there's groups out there for you. I know friends that are going to different groups where I live in Merced County, and they're seeking help after all this time of hiding, you know, something, I guess, to them, a shame. And there shouldn't be anything like that.
But thank God, though, today the American public doesn't take the frustration of war out on the people that are selected to fight the war.
Right.
And in our day and age, it was as if we chose to begin that war and that we were totally responsible. And I don't know what the change was, but at least today, Americans don't defy the military in uniform. Now, many people go up and say, thank you for serving.
Right.
And I can't imagine until I came to this church, there's only about three or four people in my 40 years that ever said thank you for serving. And one of them was my best friend, and the other times is when we came to a service here at Calgary, and so many of these people just walked up and said thank you. And I had tears in my eyes that entire day because that's what I missed. I wanted to have what my experience was be of value to something. And I was told it was of no value as soon as I came home. So
Well, again, I think that one of the reasons for that is because there was a draft then. And a lot of guys went. They didn't want to go.
Right.
They went. Everybody today, you know, they signed up.
Yes,
They're not. They're volunteers. They're not there
but
against
these
their
guys
will.
Today are going two and three.
Four
times.
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
I don't know how you escape PTSD from that.
Do you think there's going to be a draft again?
I don't think so, I think we're going to tone down the wars with our new leadership. But at the same point in time, we're going to take the focus now and put it on Afghanistan, where we should have had it, in my opinion, and take the Taliban down.
Yeah.
To the men and women today that, you know, my advice is, it's not advice. It's speaking out loud. I just say, war, you're not going to go to war and not pay a price. Everybody's different. But you can't do something as big as going to fight for your country and face an enemy down and not have some kind of price to pay after. It's like almost any experience. You know, you go to college, you have an experience. You become a professional athlete or a businessman, or there's an experience there. And there are prices to pay for certain things. And this lifestyle, this part of your lives, is going to demand some kind of payment. And when you feel that, don't be afraid to get help. Don't be afraid to talk to somebody. And because there is help out there.
Raul?
And when I came to the end of my life, I was 24 years old when I came home to kill my wife and my kids. And, you know, I just really, I wasn't a religious person.
Elaborate a little bit on that.
Yes. Well, what happened is I was really full of anger. You know, I had a problem with my dad, number one. You know, and when I came back from Vietnam, he continued to pursue after me, and I just have had it, and I told him I was going to kill him. So that what happened is my wife, verbally physical abuse for 4.5 years, and one day she's going to leave me, and nobody's going to have her or my kids. So why don't I just kill her and kill my kids and then shoot it with the police, and that's the end of that. And at that day, it was April the 15th, when I was watching Chuck Smith on TV, I hit the television, came on, and I heard a message of hope, and then my life was transformed by Jesus Christ. It changed my whole life.
Well, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. Yeah. And it's been great, you know, having you guys here. And I think this has made our Veterans Day program a very special program today. So thank you all very much. Anybody want to add anything?
I'd like to say, if there's anybody in Alpha Company 17 that happens to be listening to the Calvary broadcast, that we'd sure like you to get a hold of Reese at the church here, because we'd like to incorporate you into our family.
You know, we're heard on over 500 frequencies across the United States and Puerto Rico and other parts of the world, too. So.
Awesome. Thank you, Kim.
Okay, thanks, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bobby.
Okay.